So welcome, everyone. This is the 21st of February. 21st of February, 2009. And this is a teleconference on Pathwork Guide Lecture 84, which is Love, Power, and Serenity as Divine Attributes and as Distortions. And this is part of a series of lectures, not in numerical sequence, but sprinkled throughout a certain segment of the lectures, which you remember were given over a very long period of time, 24, 25 years. The guide would speak every 2 weeks or a month, and they would transcribe the lectures. So this is a very, very long time period. And for instance, even from lecture 43, which is the first time reason, will, and emotion were raised as personality types, to 84 was a significant period of time. This was given in 1961. And before that, in lecture 30, the original triad was begun to be discussed. So in the charts and the paperwork that I put out on the website, I've left material from the previous teleconference on reason, will, and emotion, and it has a bunch of charts in it. And charts are useful because what we're trying to do is discern and delineate between some very, very subtle drifts in personality and distortions. And so it helps to see it from different angles. So in this lecture, Love, Power, and Serenity, the guide first starts out talking about the fact that they are divine attributes. So there's nothing inherently wrong with love, power, and serenity. And the lecture does not dwell too long on the wonderful divine qualities of these attributes. It begins to talk immediately about where they go into distortion. And what the guide describes is that the dilemma becomes not each individual attribute at any particular time, but a place where the... sorry, I just got stuck. There's a piece of equipment that just malfunctioned, if you'll excuse me for just 1 second. So that was unusual. That's never happened before, but trivia. So there we go. We'll start back up a second. So the problem with, or the reason we're focusing on love, power, and serenity as divine attributes in their distortion is because when these attributes are well-balanced, okay, when the attributes alternate back and forth freely with each other, depending on where they are called forward, and where they are used in their divine perfection, this is where they shine. But when they are in distorted state, what they do is they begin to mutually exclude each other. In effect, we begin to use or value one attribute to the expense of another. Okay? So they complement and strengthen each other, is what the lecture says, and a flexibility is maintained so that none of these three attributes can ever contradict or interfere with each other until we weight one as having more value or being better, or we begin to use the attribute instead of exhibiting the attribute. So that's the place where these divine attributes fall into distortion. So the guide spends 3 or 4 pages at the beginning talking about the particular divine attribute of love, when love turns into submission. And he says that he does that because sometimes it's harder to see that as a distortion than it is for the other two in their distortion. So in terms of love, it's not the giving and receiving, the generous giving and receiving of love that obviously goes into distortion. It's a place where a must comes into this. where instead of being enthusiastic and in the moment and having eros for loving and being loved, what happens is that we feel that our self-worth has become attached to whether we give or receive love. Now, between those two, it's a little easier to see where people have a forcing current behind giving love, because that's exhibiting some aggression. That's not just submission. That's actually some aggression involved with that, where we insist that you receive our love. Where these attributes are a little sneakier and where they are perhaps a little harder to find is in submission. So I noticed that a fair amount of this lecture focused on the quality of love in terms of submission, specifically because it is not easy to detect the pride that can be attached to that. So the pride begins to exhibit itself in the fact that the person who is trying to receive love feels that they must, of course, be of a certain caliber to deserve to receive love. So they begin to emphasize areas of their personality that deserve love. And they naturally would de-emphasize, that's the beginning, very sneaky, very small, very cute. We de-emphasize just a little bit the places in us that aren't quite so lovable. So that's like the place where you first step off the beaten track. And then it begins to escalate. Because what happens when you must receive love is that you begin to imagine what kind of person you need to be to receive love. And that begins to snowball into an idealized self-image. Now, the idealized self-image we talked about a few teleconferences ago. And the dilemma with the idealized self-image is that it's frozen. It's not a real person with flaws and acne and who muffs their words and is selfish sometimes but unselfish more often than not. The idealized self-image sets the bar so high that no real person can meet it. So when we feel like we must receive love and we must be the kind of person who deserves love, then we're headed on our way to inventing an idealized self-image that we will need to meet that does not reflect our real self. So the lecture goes on to say that as a natural course of events, what happens is that when we're not allowed to be real, we actually deep down inside us react to that. So nobody really wants to be a plastic caricature of themselves. And so what happens is that we begin to resent the persona that we have to wear. And we begin to be angry at not being free, at not being creative, at not being spontaneous, but always having to be unselfish and loving and kind and wonderful and all these attributes that we've built up in our idealized self-image. So besides the fact that we can't be real, we can't be the full spectrum of who we are, which could be 99% good, 98%, but we've decided that those 2%, if somebody saw them, might make us unlovable. So once we inhabit that and become attached to it, then what enters in is the pride in being so good. So the guide proposes that goodness, its holiness, and unselfishness becomes the marker that we have to meet. And in the pride that develops from that tends to have a sense of contempt for any other human action that isn't of that caliber for two reasons. One is that we've decided what's good and bad, so there's a line drawn in the sand. But secondly, when others exhibit glitches, when they burp, when they do a cosmic fart, we see in that moment perhaps a bit of who we are. And there is a judgment of them that is actually a judgment of our real self. So in other words, we're trying to mask who we really are. We're trying to erase all the bad bits. And when someone else displays it, there's almost a sense of, why do you get to be real when I don't? And secondly, a reminder that we're like that too. So for all these distortions that we talk about, we know what is real. I think that more people have a sense of truth than perhaps are willing to admit it. We don't want to be arrogant, we don't want to act like we know everything, and we don't want to judge other people. And yet, there's a place where we know the truth when we hear it. And we know when something's not right when we hear it. And when I work with people, one of the things I count on is that they know. There's an innate part of them that really wants to be whoever they are and who is tired of the game and the charade. And that's why when this work is done, the reason it's not just therapy trying to fix twitches and dilemmas and piece things back together, the reason it's spiritual work is part of our work is to activate, to reach and to activate and stimulate the divine qualities in people, their real self, bring in their higher self energies, bring in their positive intention, bring in that little piece that says, I don't think this is right. I don't know quite what it is, but this isn't right. Now, you could be wrong. Maybe that is right. But it's in the exploration that we can find this out. And a fear of exploring is not conducive to your finding the truth. So to support people in finding the truth, in trying to help them not be afraid of who they really, really are, it's very useful to bring forward or to coax forward or to invite the higher self positive intention. It's kind of the equivalent of turning yourself in. What we do when we go on a spiritual journey looking for the truth is we have begun the process of believing that the truth would be of more value than the white lies or the illusions that we have been living under. It's a very, very powerful process. And it may take a long time or a lot of effort, but that's the journey, so there we are. So in looking at somebody leaned on their key there. In looking at submissiveness, okay, there's a lot of truth in love. And there's truth in compromise. There's truth in bending a little bit to be with other people, in not making demands that it be your way, in trying to understand how other people see the world. But we're talking about going just a tad further than that. We're talking about submitting to their views about what is good rather than standing up for ours. Now, I don't submit a lot now in my life. So when I look at my own life, I find a lot of submission, but it's not, the huge bits aren't as recent, perhaps, as for other people. And people laugh because they say, you're kidding. And I say, no, I submitted. I submitted a lot in my life. It's a lesson that I learned. And it took me, let's give it 3, maybe 4 decades, to learn that you can't buy love. And I learned that by trying. And that's what we do. So from a spiritual perspective, we're looking at a very, very long timeline here. You don't have to get this by the time you're 7.5 years old. You don't have to get this by the time you're 22. These lessons are life lessons. And the invitation in the lectures is to take all the time you need to go as fast or as slow as you are prompted to do, and to find your way through the examination of your life and your values at your own pace. Now, for instance, in reading the lecture, I always get surprised. It's embarrassing sometimes because you're teaching a lecture and you know the lecture and you read it and go, wow, I didn't remember that part. In the questions and answers at the back, their guide says over and over again something that can be infuriating, and that is you cannot generalize. And people naturally are looking for clear delineation. It's useful. It's not that we want to be boxed. But we have a tendency that if we have this and that clearly delineated, it's easier to see. But the guide, when asked certain questions, kept saying over and over again, you cannot generalize about this work. It is unique to each individual. And what I'm inviting you to see in that, there's frustration. He's not giving me an answer. He's not giving me pointers. If you just tell me what to fix, I'd fix it. Okay. But that's not really what the work is. What the work is to find it. And part of the value of this kind of spiritual transformative work is to see how long it took you to find it. Now, that might seem backwards to some people, but if you are looking at a part of you that is in distortion so tight and you're so blind that it takes you 20 years to see it, I invite you to see what a victory that is when you finally see it. So in the process of looking at lectures, if you're inspired to look at it, if you're inspired to say, ooh, this lecture is really, really interesting, the learning of a lecture, the learning of a concept, or the learning of your own distortions is a little bit like an artichoke. And I remember the first time I saw an artichoke. I don't consider myself dumb or unsophisticated, but it just so happens that I never saw one before until I was 18 years old. And it was put on my plate at a family dinner with some people I knew. And it doesn't look edible. If you don't have experience with an artichoke, it can be a little mystifying. And not realizing how gauche I could be with food, it never occurred to me I knew so little bit about food. I kept looking for the part you eat. And I kept peeling the leaves off and pulling them off and pulling them aside until I got down to the heart. And, of course, the heart is full of very, very tiny, disgusting, irritating hairs that you don't want to eat. And that is when I finally looked up to see the entire table looking at me. Absolutely aghast, because I thought I was a normal, reasonable person who knew food stuff. And not wanting to laugh at me, because they were kind people. But there I was with this artichoke spread all over my plate looking for the part to eat, because I didn't recognize what you ate in an artichoke, even when you got down to the heart of it. So the game is not about how many leaves can I tear off my personality until I get to the good stuff or resolve it. The game is not what do I cast off. And I use the word game because it is a bit of a game. From a divine perspective, we're here because we're full of positive intention and we have a goal and we have a task and we're here with zest and enthusiasm and energy. The idea is not to cast off all these bits that don't seem to make sense, but to consider what they're doing there. Why was this structure put together in the first place? From a divine perspective, who are you? What were you trying to find? That your personality with all its distortions is a little bit like a treasure map. And you can find interesting things out about yourself as a spirit if you treat these layers of distortion with respect. And of course it doesn't mean that you don't try to work with them, but instead of casting them off, isn't that interesting? So isn't it interesting that it took me 30 or 40 years to stop submitting? When once you do that, you realize how silly and useless and distorted it was and how it didn't work, and you realize all these things. But that's like the those 3D pictures that you look on the wall, and you look at them and you cock your head to one side and you unfocus, and people are trying to help, and if they stand back another foot, and then wow, you get it. All of a sudden, it's right there in front of you. And once you get it, you don't forget. You can get it in an instant. You can go by that picture and pick up what it's about. But that moment of just not knowing what you're looking at and not realizing where the outlines of the object are and just dealing with all these fuzzy bits that make no sense to you, that's where we start from when we look at personality. That's where we start from when we look at spirituality. So, again, the guide talks about the divine, how love can turn into a distortion. Partly, I believe, because it's sneaky how it does that. And love and distortion can create a person who seems to work unselfishly and wholeheartedly for common goals. And so society supports that. There's a big yay for people who support other people's efforts, who give and give unselfishly, who are always there, who are always willing, who always have a smile on their face and are cheering up everybody else. And the part of that that is honest and true, that's not the problem. But what happens if you're grumpy and you don't want to do something one day? If in your idealized self-image, you either don't believe that saying no is appropriate, or if you feel that you're actually trying to earn love, and the day you don't show up, people might think badly of you, then showing up is not honest. It's not really who you are. It's a submission to the values of others, to the needs of others at your expense, and to the tyranny of your own idealized self-image that you have built up. Now, I can think of another example. I was going to a play one time. My daughter was in a play. And I asked a friend to join us because we had to travel a ways, and I thought that'd be nice. They could come with us. And they said, well, what's the topic of the play? And it was some Norwegian thing. I'm really sorry. I can't remember, but, you know, not Stravinsky, but you get the idea. Some classic play about suicide. And my friend said, no, thank you. I'm really not in a place where I want to spend the evening watching a play about suicide. And I remember being absolutely aghast, because to me that had nothing to do with it. I was going to support my daughter, and I thought my friend would want to support me and my daughter, and the subject of the play wasn't even in my thinking. And I was angry at my friend. But it took perhaps a week or a week and a half where it started to dawn on me that this person was showing self-care for themselves. What they were saying is, I love you, I love your daughter, I would be happy to support you, but I really can't be there 100% for you today. So perhaps I'll choose another time or another place where I can be wholeheartedly in support. But this time I would be in mask. And the truth is, at that time in my life, I was living so much in mask, I thought that was normal. Why don't you be in mask? And that's what this distortion of love can create. a place where we're living in a mask so long and so often that we don't know what mask is. So it can be kind of fun when you first do this work, because there's a, like archaeology, there's the, you use the big shovels for a while, and that gets the energy going, and it's a lot of fun, and you get a lot of things done. And then you use the smaller shovels, and then you get down to the trowels. And after a while with this work, you're sitting there with the tweezers, sifting through the little tiny shards of tissue paper, trying to find things. So when we look for mask and distortion, these can be big layers of our personality. But again, we're not trying to rip them off or throw them away. What we're trying to find out is this real? And there's a phrase, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And I picked up some trivia about what that meant. And I think it's kind of cute and perhaps apropos here. In the old days, you know, those good old days where everybody was happy and everything worked right, you only took a bath once a week or once a month. And when you had a family of 10 children and several adults, the rule was that the head of the household got the hot water first, and then it went down the line through all the kids until the last person who was bathed was the baby. Now, and I find it amusing, the idea of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because the bathwater at that point is pretty murky. And the idea of not being able to find the baby in the bathwater and emptying the tub. Anyway, sorry, that's my cockeyed sense of humor. But I think it's apropos here in this. You're not trying to throw away love. You're not trying to throw away submission as a reality that occurs when people try to get along with each other. What this lecture is about is when the natural alternation of taking care of me, taking care of you, when that natural ebb and flow like the tide doesn't just come in and out, when we try to dam it up and make it only happen one way, that's when we go into distortion. There's another lecture, forget the number, called The Anatomy of Contraction. It talks about the same thing, that there's a cycle to life. There's a breathing in and a breathing out, and there's a pause. And everybody pauses someplace in the breathing cycle. It's just not natural to not pause or hesitate. Some people pause at the intake, and some people pause at the bottom of the breath. There's no right or wrong about this. You pause where you pause. Some people pause in two places. Some people pause for a long time. So there's an exercise that is done sometimes where you copy the breathing of another person. And it is a fascinating exercise because it takes so little time and so little effort. And it tells you so much about how individual we are. And if you know somebody and you want to try it, it takes 2 minutes. And what you do is you copy the breathing of the other person. They breathe normally, and you watch them, and you take your breath exactly at their pace, pausing wherever they pause, and letting the breath out. And in this class that I was in, it was startling because we found it very painful and difficult to copy somebody else's breathing pattern. Number one, it wasn't normal. Number two, some of us breathe in quickly and take our time letting out. And it was difficult for us to push air out and take a long time letting the air in. For something as simple as breath, we are highly individualistic. So when you get a bunch of people in a room together and they're all doing something at the same time, you're going to need to compromise at some point. You're going to need to figure a rhythm, like a tidal flow, between what you want and what I want. And again, this goes into distortion only when there's an artificiality in the natural flow. So in terms of pride, in this particular distortion of love in terms of submissiveness, the guide says, so he feels proud of his self-sacrificing martyrdom, superior in spiritual development or ethical standards. Pride, hypocrisy, and pretense are present in all the attitudes, love, power, and serenity, when incorporated in the idealized self-image. But the submissive type will have a harder time finding the pride, while the aggressive type will have a harder time finding the pretense. So then the lecture goes on. Any questions at this point? Okay. So then, at that point, the lecture goes on. He talks about the second category being the seeker for power.
Okay. Jen, so, it's Wendy here.
Yes, Wendy.
Can I just interrupt? And something came up just in the last couple of days where my sister-in-law and brother-in-law wanted something of ours that at a value that was less than what it was worth. And they called me selfish for saying no. And but I discussed it with Barry afterwards, and he was saying something like, oh, it's only a little bit. And I said, if I gave that to them, I would resent them. And it was a real eye-opener to feel, I mean, I've obviously been submissive a lot before, but that resentment was quite an eye-opener. Yeah.
That's a beautiful realization. Because as small as it may be, what I hear in your voice and in your saying it is you realize that that wouldn't go away the next day.
Yeah.
So imagine how it's like a grain of sand in your eye. It could be fairly, fairly small, but it can irritate you. It can actually ruin a relationship. So that's a very powerful observation. Thank you very much for sharing that.
Thank you.
So anyone else? I pause sometimes to give you space, but not to put pressure on you. But if anybody wants to add anything, they're certainly welcome to do it. Okay. So
I
go
have
on.
A question, Jen.
Yes.
This is Leia.
Yes.
You made a distinction between in a submissive personality type of behavior, it's hard to find, I lost that part, versus the aggressive type where it's hard to find the pretense.
Okay. For the submissive type, it is hard to find the pride. In other words, what I hear the guide saying is that because the submissive type is hiding behind a cloak of goodness, they may see that as submission and not realizing that they're pushing a certain value system, that they have decided a certain value system is better. It's like you're underneath it with your shoulder shoving it upward, and you think of yourself as working very hard. You think of yourself as supporting something wonderful. But you're not seeing the larger picture. You're not seeing where you can be enforcing something onto other people. And you enforce it with an inherent, but that's good. So this is where, I know you've seen the chart, where it lists spiritual pride. Spiritual pride is one of the distortions, one of the defenses of the emotion type. Does that help?
Yeah, just the distinction was interesting. I have not put them next to each other in that kind of way, so thank you.
Yeah, I sometimes laugh because I need to read these lectures way ahead of time so I don't get surprised an hour before the teleconference. Because as I was reading this, I noticed how the guide marries, if we talk about reason, will, and emotion, he marries the emotion, will, distortion. And then he marries the reason and will distortions. And that, of course, has some truth to it. And the reason why it has truth is that everybody's a will type. We all exercise will. We all have some form of push bringing us forward into this world. So there are no pure absolute reason types, and there are no pure absolute emotion types. So you get, in effect, a rainbow spectrum. And if it isn't a rainbow, it's from, you know, this is probably a bad analogy, but if you go from black to white, it's all gray. Except for the ends, for which there is no absolute in human nature. You're just talking about shades of gray. Are you more in the black or dark gray? Are you more in the white or light gray? And so when the guide talks about the nuances of this, he very commonly talks about that little bit of will holding up the distortions of the emotion type. And that's where it becomes prideful instead of a simple mask. So the emotion type is not devoid of will. But they may, in a weak way, want the goodness of their position to substitute for their own self-responsibility in putting forward what they believe is right. In other words, we hide under goodness that is universally accepted because we don't want to put out what we think is good because we could get into arguments with other people. So that's where the somebody who's way, way over on the one end of the spectrum with emotion will use their will to pull in extra, the words that are coming to me is combative power. That's not the right word. But they'll try to bring in some enforcement, some force to help support them in what they actually want. Some validation. Now, in the last teleconference, we talked about the three principles of evil. And in that lecture, the emotion type would be using, once again, nobody's a type, but it's a way of discussing things. The emotion type would use half-truth. So the emotion type would use reason, but without respect for it, to try to bolster what they want. And the reason type would utilize proof to bolster what they actually want. It's in that little bolstering that we see the will in both types. Okay. So a sheer emotion type who simply believed that connection was the best thing would just wander the streets looking for connection and just accept whatever connection was given to them. But very few of us are like that. And if we saw somebody like that, we'd probably think they were unhinged. So this is where in the lecture, the guide is talking about a spectrum, and it's like a fulcrum. And it goes back and forth from reason to emotion, and will is the force that pushes it back and forth. So remembering that a will type might utilize both ends of the spectrum. In other words, a true will type is balancing back and forth trying to find an advantage. Whereas some of us lean towards one side naturally and others lean to the other side. So there is no type, and it says, there's a quote in the lecture, but I can't find it right now, that basically says, we all have little bits and pieces of everything. Nobody's devoid of these qualities. So the question becomes, well, why would I study it? And the answer would be, you study what interests you, and you study what is active in your life in a distorted fashion. So that's how you would select which lecture or which concept that you might want to work with, because you resonated with it. And it's that resonance that I'm talking about when I talk about we know. In our gut, we know this lecture is talking about us, if this is the lecture we're attracted to. We know there's something here we need. We may not know what it is, and it could take years to to really understand what it is. But that's not the point. You need to start someplace, and it is that bit of intuition that leads you to read something or to focus on it or to remember a quote for years on end. So when the guide moves into the second category, talking about the seeker for power, okay, remembering that with reasonable and emotion, the emotion type is most afraid of lack of connection. That's their idea of purgatory, of hell. And for the will type, their idea of the worst thing that could possibly happen would be to be helpless. So naturally, the attribute that they would want to activate would be power. Because if I have and use power, then I can prevent this thing that I am afraid of. But power alone, a will type just doesn't sit here saying, I have power and I will use it when it's appropriate. Because if they do that, that's not a distortion. And what we're talking about here is a place where somebody has power and wants to activate it either just in case or because they really feel that helplessness is a current threat. So the person with a power drive will try to compete and try to be better than everyone else. So again, I'm sure that all of you have stories about times and places where perhaps you were the equivalent of coming in last. And if there was going to be a decision made that there are 10 people in the room and the first 5 people who finish will go on to something else and the second 5 will not go on, then naturally we would try very hard to finish in the first 5. It's human nature. And that activates our natural competitiveness. But it is most powerful to anyone who fears being helpless. And part of helpless would be being left out, because once you're out, you have no power in that arrangement. So everyone might hurry up a little bit or watch each other or watch the clock, and everybody who's left behind might feel really bad. But in distortion, what we're talking about here is a person with a power drive who simply cannot afford to lose. We have to be included. We have to win. We have to be far enough away from that cutoff point to feel safe. So what the guide says here is that the pride in the image of the power drive is very honest. But the dishonesty is not. And the dishonesty is the fact that the person with a power drive tends to restrict anything that would seem to get in their way, such as feelings, such as contradictory situations. The person with a power drive would falsely clarify a situation so that they could move forward. Because a little bit of chaos or I'm not sure means they can't drive through a situation. And when you clarify something or you say you over here and you over there, when there's no particular reason to do that except your own fear, this is hypocrisy. This is pretense. This is the power mask. And the power math says this has to be done now. The aggression is called for. Because they're not open to the possibility of not using their power. And they're not open to it because they're afraid. They see things in terms of win-lose, and if they're open, they might have to accept losing. And a real power type can't accept losing, unless they reimagine it into winning. So the human mind, being creative, we can do a lot of things that look like losing to one person. We've convinced ourselves that, no, that's not losing. That's really winning. And we partly do that to save face. And so we can go into something enthusiastically instead of feeling like we're going to fall over a cliff. So this is where risky behavior and doing things that other people think are foolhardy, that's all in the mind of the person involved. For someone else, they might see that taking the chance is the best opportunity they've got, and what they're saying is, I'm willing to take risks, because if I win, that really will be good for everybody. And the mask part of that would be that it would make them stronger. It would give them more power. And like the emotion type, it would give them more power because people like and respect winners. And this is the kind of pride that the power type has that holds a pretense. So they're not submitting as much to public opinion as they are in trying to create public opinion so that they can design their own future, so that they can feel safe. But can you feel the fear that is still driving power when it is in distortion? Now, I've had lots of discussions for lots of years with people because I tend to be a little aggressive. And there's a tendency sometimes in spiritual work to tamp down aggression and to look at softer aspects of personality. And I'm exaggerating, of course, but I sometimes feel like a bull in a china shop. And so I've become somewhat experienced at looking at my own motives, because I agree that sometimes that's about feeling safe and being in charge and getting my way. That, hands down, sometimes I'm guilty. But there are other occasions where aggression is and can be a positive force. And I hold a space, I like to hold a space, where, as I said before, with the submissive, with the love defense of submissiveness, compromise is called for sometimes. Even bad compromise is called for sometimes. We need to get along, we need to work together. Can't always agree. Sometimes power and aggression is called for. Even the guide says that wars on this planet are an unfortunate reality, and they won't go away soon. They will go away. We can do something about it. But sometimes you need to go to war as human beings when wrong is being done, when negative aggression is hurting people, when there's something at stake that is of value, you may need to go to war. The trick is to keep that, in as much as you can, leashed into positive aggression rather than revenge or retribution, or to fall into the trap of your side, my side, God's on my side, you're wrong, and make that a moral judgment. So again, positive aggression per se, aggression per se is neutral. So when you look at any one aspect, this goes back to what the guide says about you cannot generalize. You cannot say that X is wrong inherently. You need to look at X. You need to look at the situation. Need to look at context. How did it get there? What track is it on? Is it in the process of becoming seen and heard? Then it's a good thing that it comes to the surface. So that's a little bit about the power type. What I'm going to do right now is I'm going to take a brief break.